Hello and welcome to Ox Talk for Tuesday, the 25th of February 2025. My name is Guy and I've compiled the edition for this week. News items have been selected from local Oxford papers by Leslie Court and Margaret Simpson and recorded at home by Leslie Court and Kristen Dennison. The USBs have been copied and distributed by Michelle Lawful. Sunrise today is at 6:58 a.m. and sunset is at 5:38 p.m. Before the news, we mark some events which happened on February the 25th in history. In 1570, Pope Pius V issued a papal bull titled Regnans in Excelsis, meaning reigning on high, which excommunicated Queen Elizabeth I of England for heresy and persecution of English Catholics. The bull also absolved all Catholic subjects from allegiance to the crown and actively encouraged their disobedience. In 1862, the first Legal Tender Act was passed by the US Congress, authorizing the United States note, also known as the greenback, into circulation. It was the first fiat paper money that was legal tender in America, in that it was not backed by a physical commodity like gold or silver. In 1957, Buddy Holly and the Crickets recorded their smash hit That'll Be the Day in Clovis, New Mexico. This recording was certified gold for over a million US sales by the Recording Industry Association of America in 1969 and was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1998. In 2005, it was placed in the National Recording Registry, a list of sound recordings that are culturally, historically, and or aesthetically important, and or inform or reflect life in the United States. In 1980, the British political comedy Yes Minister, written by Anthony Jay and Jonathan Lynn, and starring Paul Eddington, Nigel Hawthorne, and Derek Folds, premiered on BBC Two. It ran over 8 years and five seasons, the last two being titled Yes Prime Minister, until the 28th of January 1988. In 1995, singer Frank Sinatra performed for the final time before a live audience. 1,200 select guests at the Palm Desert Marriott Ballroom in Palm Desert, California, watched him on the closing night of his charity golf tournament. Births on this day. In 1841, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, French Impressionist painter and sculptor, was born in Limoges, France. His family moved to Paris when he was three, living close to the Louvre. He frequently visited the Louvre during his time as an apprentice in a porcelain factory. The owner of the factory recognized Renoir's talent, and thus he began his move into art as a profession. In 1937, Sir Tom Courtenay, English actor, was born in Kingston-upon-Hull in the East Riding of Yorkshire. During his career, Courtenay has received numerous accolades, including 3 BAFTA Awards and a Golden Globe Award, as well as nominations for 2 Academy Awards, 2 Tony Awards, and an Emmy Award. He was knighted for his services to cinema and theatre in the 2001 New Year Honours. He is probably best known for his roles in The Dresser, Dr. Zhivago, and To Catch a Spy. In 1943, George Harrison, British guitarist, singer, songwriter, and sitar player of Beatles fame, was born in Wavertree, Liverpool. Harrison contributed several songs to Beatles albums, and following their breakup, he pursued a solo career, his first record being My Sweet Lord in 1970. He also had a hit with the supergroup Travelling Wilburys, which also featured Jeff Lynne, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan and Tom Petty, with the single Handle With Care. Harrison was also a film producer on Monty Python's The Life of Brian and The Time Bandits. And deaths on this day. In 778 or 779, Saint Walpurga, Anglo-Saxon abbess and missionary to the Frankish Empire, died. She was canonized on the 1st of May around 870 by Pope Adrian II, and St. Walpurgis Night became the name for the eve of her feast day in the medieval period. The name is still used for May Eve by some. In 1723, Christopher Wren, English architect, astronomer, mathematician, and physicist, died aged 90. He is one of the most highly acclaimed architects in the history of England. Known for his work in the English Baroque style, he was responsible for rebuilding 52 churches in the City of London after the Great Fire in 1666, including what is regarded as his masterpiece, St. Paul's Cathedral on Ludgate Hill, completed in 1710. In 1983, Tennessee Williams, American playwright and screenwriter, died aged 71. Along with contemporaries Eugene O'Neill and Arthur Miller, he is considered among the three foremost playwrights of 20th century American drama. He is probably best known for A Streetcar Named Desire, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and The Night of the Iguana. Now on to the news. We hope you enjoy our selection of articles.
A restaurant named in honor of crime writer Agatha Christie has retained its position in the Michelin Guide. Five Little Pigs in St. Mary Street, Wallingford, was first mentioned in the coveted list after setting up shop in 2021. At an award ceremony, the stylish bistro was told it had kept its spot in the guide to good restaurants. The team behind the restaurant said, "That cheerful, puffy Michelin guy sure knows what he's doing, releasing the guide at this time of year. It's cold, gloomy, and it can all feel a bit hard. But as always, whilst we're not in the business of doing this malarkey for the accolades, they are a most welcome reward. It's put a big smile on all our faces today." Named after the nursery rhyme and novel by Wallingford's Agatha Christie, who lived in nearby Winterbrook House, the eatery has gone down a huge success with diners in the town since it opened, too. The trio behind the restaurant are Rob McGregor, Sam Smith, and Amy Collins. A description of the restaurant in the guide says, "This neighborhood restaurant is divided into three areas. The brightly colored front resembles a modern bistro. A bar fits in the center. And the rear sports an open kitchen pass and cozy booths." More than a third of five-year-olds in Oxford have tooth decay, it has been revealed. The figures, which have been published by the Office for Health Improvement and Disparities, show the estimated proportion of five-year-olds in England in 2024 with some kind of tooth decay by area. They show the percentage of five-year-olds estimated to have enamel and or dentin, which is the layer of the tooth that is just below the enamel, decay. In Oxford, 33.9% of the five-year-olds are estimated to have some form of tooth decay. Meanwhile, in West Oxfordshire, the figure sits at 25.4%. The area with the highest is Manchester, with 60.8%.
Plans have emerged for a new city centre cinema on the site of one of Oxford's former Odeon venues. A licensing application has been submitted to resurrect the former Odeon in Magdalen Street, which closed its doors in 2023. The application was lodged by Alejandro Wyatt, who runs a cinema in Burnham-on-Crouch. Mr. Wyatt registered a new company on Companies House in January called Roxy Movies, the Oxford Cinema Limited. The proposal is to turn the historical venue into a cinema and cafe. His application to Oxford City Council is to be open 7 days a week from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. Mr. Wyatt has previously restored cinemas in North Wales, Essex and Norfolk. The move comes after Oxford's second Odeon in Oxford in Gloucester Green in Oxford closed its doors for the final time at the end of January to make way for controversial plans from Oxford City Council to demolish the building and redevelop it. The closure of the historic venue, one of the last remaining family cinemas in the city, was branded a huge loss by dismayed moviegoers. The city now only has the Curzon Cinema in the Westgate, plus the Phoenix in Jericho, Ultimate Picture Palace on Cowley Road, and View in Grenoble Road. Fears have been raised the View by Kassam Stadium will be on its way out as part of the Ozone Leisure Park reimagined scheme. There were concerns it would mean the end for the cinema, but developers have said there is a desire for a new cinema to be included in the new scheme. However, this would likely be smaller than the View, with around three or four screens. A petition to save the cinema has now been signed by 2,359 people since launching on February the 14th. On the petition, Anna Rose said, "We live a short walk from the centre and enjoy dinner and bowling there or going to the cinema. It's a thriving local leisure facility and there's nothing else like it in Oxford. Always filled with people of all ages, such a popular and important venue. They should be expanding it to more restaurants and seating areas, not closing it." The old cinema in Magdalen Street was first opened in 1924 and changed hands multiple times before being bought by Odeon in 2000. The Grade II listed building was built by renowned theatre constructors Frank Matcham and Company and boasts 1,000 seats. The cinema's first showing was the silent film The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse on January the 1st, 1924.
Film fans concerned at plans to redevelop Oxford's Ozone Leisure Park at the Kassam Stadium have been reassured that a new cinema will be built as part of any plans. Householders on the city's Blackbird Lees estate have joined movie lovers to oppose plans to close the View Cinema next to Oxford United's ground. Plans are being drawn up by the Fyros Kassam Fiorka Group, which owns the land, along with developers Pioneer Group and project managers Bidwells, to replace the View, bowling alley, and restaurants in the site off Grenoble Road. The redevelopment, known as Ozone Leisure Park Reimagined, will include new labs, offices, and community facilities. There were fears it would mean the loss of a cinema altogether, but developers have said there is a desire for a new cinema to be included in the new scheme. However, this would likely be smaller than the 9-screen View multiplex, having only 3 or 4 screens. Since the plan was announced last week, a campaign has formed to oppose the plans, with people living in Blackbird Lees saying the new cinema will be a downgrade for locals. The loss of the View Cinema follows the closure of Oxford's 2 Odeon cinemas, leaving movie lovers with only the smaller Ultimate Picture Palace off Cowley Road, Phoenix Picture House in Jericho, and Curzon in the Westgate. An online campaign group called Save the Ozone Complex has been started by Pete White and has gained more than 250 members since it was formed on Thursday in response to the plans. Mr. White said, "The Ozone Complex at Kassam Stadium must remain to save young adult jobs and to keep the cinemas local. This is our space where we go as families. We do not want anyone reimagining our leisure." In addition, a petition has been started by Payam Attar, which gained more than 200 signatures on its first day. Mr. Attar said, "The View Cinema and the bowling alleys are visited by thousands every year, playing a significant role in our local economy as well as supporting a wide range of jobs. These venues serve as a source of relaxation and fun for many, from families spending quality time together, to youngsters enjoying their first taste of independence, to the elderly finding companionship in shared hobbies. It comes as Oxford United are planning on moving to a new stadium in Kidlington, meaning the Kassam Stadium, which is next door to the Ozone Leisure Park site, will be redeveloped subject to planning permission. The scheme, which is still in its pre-application phase, is separate from the Magdalen College plan for 3,000 homes off Grenoble Road." A spokesman for the Ozone Leisure Park Reimagined project said, "At the heart of the redevelopment is a bold vision to create a community innovation district that inspires the local community, celebrates Oxford's world-leading research, and creates access to jobs and opportunities. Transition by Design, our Oxford-based community engagement consultants, will be leading opportunities to co-design the leisure and community elements of the project. The developers will be attending community events in February and March to hear people's ideas and thoughts." A wildlife center hosted a creative crafting session to explore environmental issues. Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, and Oxfordshire Wildlife Trust held the workshop at its Sutton Courtney Environmental Education Center. The session, titled "Crafting a Future We'd Be Proud to Leave for Future Generations," was a community event to create artworks inspired by hopes and concerns relating to climate change. The theme this year was butterflies, following last year's session where crafters made willow and fabric gloves, now on display in the center. Event organizers said the activity is also a chance to discuss any environmental issues that are on your mind with other like-minded people in a supportive atmosphere and seek effective action that we can take as individuals and communities.
A campaign has been launched to save a church which will be going up for sale as local groups fear they will lose their home. Summertown United Reformed Church on Banbury Road closed for worship in 2022 after 179 years, but is still used extensively by local arts groups. After the closure of Summertown URC, the Wessex Synod Trust, which owns the building, continued to hire out the premises to community groups, but now intends to sell it. A group of users have come together as Summertown Arts Community, SAC, to raise money to buy the premises. The building is registered with Oxford City Council as an asset of heritage value, and the SAC has registered it as an asset of community value. Under the terms of the asset of community value, SAC had 6 months from the end of January to put together a credible offer, meaning the group now has until July the 28th to buy it. The building is used by local arts groups for classes, workshops and rehearsals in dance, drama, music and visual arts, as well as by visiting churches, the Summertown Church Partnership and other community groups. The facilities include the main church, a community hall with a professional standard sprung dance floor, a back meeting room, kitchen, a vestry and two upstairs studio spaces. Summertown Arts Community was established in 2021 to represent the current users, and the group's intention is to raise enough capital to purchase the facilities from the Wessex Trust of the United Reformed Church in order to maintain the premises as a centre for arts in the community. SAC has been holding fundraising events. Susie Crowe, who co-manages the venue on behalf of the owners with Peter Street, said, "It is an essential resource in a city which has very few spaces publicly available for arts practice. If the premises are sold, but not to Summertown Arts Community, we do not know what will then happen, whether it will be closed down by the new owners. If SAC is successful in purchasing, then it will carry on renting the spaces to the increasing number of groups and individuals who want to work there." A spokesperson for the Wessex Synod Trust said, "The Trust has agreed to give Susie Crowe and Peter Street until July 2025 to raise the funds to purchase the property and is taking steps to advise, through a professional valuation, what offer would be acceptable."
Oxford United have confirmed that a fan who had a cardiac arrest during the game against Portsmouth is in stable condition. The match was paused close to the quarter of an hour mark as emergency services dealt with the incident in the home end of the North Stand. Both sets of players left the pitch with the game getting back underway following a delay of more than half an hour. United said, "Following a medical emergency which took place during today's Sky Bet Championship game at home to Portsmouth, Oxford United can confirm a supporter suffered a cardiac arrest during the first half. We are pleased to report they are now in a stable condition and are receiving further treatment in hospital. The club would like to place on record our thanks to the on-site medical team from St. John Ambulance and South Central Ambulance Service, Thames Valley Police, stadium stewards, and off-duty paramedics who arrived on the scene within 30 seconds. CPR was administered and the person concerned was eventually resuscitated before being taken to hospital. We would also like to thank the supporters in the area for the part they played." From Memory Lane. We know how popular steam trains still are more than 50 years after they were withdrawn from general service by British Railways. Didcot Railway Centre continues to attract thousands of enthusiasts keen to see its wide range of locomotives and other memorabilia. Even model railways catch the imagination of rail buffs young and old, as was shown in our 1988 article. It was taken by Oxford Mail photographer Susie Barker at Oxford Model Railways Club's annual show at Oxford Town Hall. We see Sophie Biles, 10, of Tame, Craig Garland, 9, of Didcot, and Philip McMillan, 10, of Abingdon, alongside a model of a steam engine built by Doug and Jim Turner. The locomotive, number 1003 and named Gazelle, carries the initials LNER, London and North Eastern Railway. The 1988 show, the 23rd year it had been held, included an impressive range of stands, displays, and stalls. One of the best layouts was from the Abingdon and District Model Railway Club, based on the Somerset to Dorset railway line. Its 20 feet of track took up to 5 years of painstaking labor to create, with nearly 4,000 miniature sleepers supporting the rails. Other popular displays included a miniature replica of a Cornish tin mine, a complete working model built from scratch over 3 years by Robert Tivendale.
Concerns have been raised over plans for a new Oxford Hospital building because of its proximity to a city wildlife habitat. Oxford University is seeking planning permission from the City Council to introduce a modular manufacturing building at the Churchill Hospital site in Headington. The nearly 3,000 square metre development would act as an extension to the existing clinical biomanufacturing facility and assist in making medical equipment as part of a key link in the chain between the academics and the trials that will develop future drugs and vaccines. A planning paper describes this as an important social benefit to the proposal and adds, "The academic research, trials and teaching the applicant undertakes at its sites in Headington play a crucial role in the life science sector, so key to the modern Oxford economy. However, people are concerned it poses a risk to the nearby Lye Valley. Despite this, Oxford City Council planning officers have recommended it for permission ahead of the planning committee meeting. A total of 27 people have submitted objections in addition to the Wrens of Lye Valley group. Rachel Lloyd of Lye Valley said, "I object strongly to this development, which is only 82 metres from the Lye Valley SSI's Fens High Level West Side Spring. I need reassurance the spring flow and chemistry upon which the Fen wildlife depends will not be damaged. Every other planning application within the rainwater catchment has to provide such documentation for public scrutiny. Why is this case different? I fully endorse the Friends of Lye Valley Committee's objection." Mike Boone of Ramsey Road added, "I understand that Oxford needs to develop its scientific work, but that should not be at the cost of our special green environments, such as Lye Valley, within the city. These are vital to the health and well-being of our citizens. There has recently been housing development near Lye Valley, and it appears that this unique treasure is being chosen for environmental abuse. You may not understand the ecology of the site, but please appreciate that the land around Lye Valley needs to be protected." In the planning officer's report, it said, "In summary, the proposed development is acceptable in regards of its design and would not cause any detrimental harm upon the character and appearance of the surrounding area, nor the setting of the non-designated heritage assets on the wider Churchill Hospital site. The proposals would not cause any detrimental impacts upon the amenity of any neighbouring occupiers, nor would the proposals cause any impacts in relation to highways and car parking, bicycle storage, sustainable design and construction, land quality, archaeology, nor trees. In addition, the proposal would not cause any detrimental impacts with regards to drainage, biodiversity and the Lye Valley SSSI."
The long-standing tradition of a running race involving pancakes will return to an Oxfordshire town next month. Wallingford's Pancake Day race is back and set to take place on Shrove Tuesday, March 4th, in Market Place. The time-honored tradition has been taking place at the end of winter every year for as long as many townspeople can remember, and no one quite knows how it began. John Houston of Wallingford took over organizing the race 16 years ago when the club that originally put it on ran out of steam. He said, "We're not really sure how long it's been going, but we definitely think now it's one of the oldest and biggest in the country. We can track it back about 45 or 50 years, but we're sure it's been going on before that. I have no idea how it started. It's been going on so long that it just feels like forever." Participants can turn up on the day with nothing but a frying pan to take part, as pancakes are provided, and fancy dress is encouraged. The race is a short loop around Market Place with the added requirement of a pancake flip at the start line. Apart from a four-year obligatory break during the COVID-19 pandemic, the race has been run every year by kids and adults, extended to include local schools when Mr. Houston took over. Six or seven races will be run by children as young as 5 years old, all of whom will receive a prize for participating. And then the adult race begins with the alluring prize of the golden frying pan. It can get quite competitive, Mr. Houston said. Some people are desperate for the golden frying pan, but really people just want to come out and have a bit of fun and raise some money for good causes. The adult competition is a 5-minute race, during which time racers will lap the course as many times as they can, tossing their pancakes every time they pass the invigilator at the start line. Whoever is in the lead after the 5 minutes are up will win the coveted pan, which they hold on to for a year and have their name etched into a plaque. Sponsors of the event, like Rouse Honey and some local businesses in Wallingford, also contribute towards a wine and gift hamper for the fastest racer. This year's race is dedicated to Ivy Small of Wallingford, who died this year, aged 91, who was a regular at the Pancake Day race. A tech boss has been made an honorary fellow of an Oxford college. Charles Skinner, the CEO of data management company Restore, has been inducted as an honorary fellow of Oriel College. This was in recognition of his years of service to the college as a member of the Finance and Estates Committee and former chair of the Investment Advisory Committee. Mr. Skinner also sat on employment panels and provided financial advice for the college. The provost described Mr. Skinner as a great friend to Oriel. He said he was very grateful for Mr. Skinner's contributions to the college, which began when he was elected president of the Junior Common Room in 1979. The provost was Mr. Skinner's contemporary at Oriel and recalled him as a student, saying, "He loved classics and still enjoys a Horatian ode. He also found time for deep equine sporting analysis and the study of the complex mathematics of gambling." Mr. Skinner said, "The same as other alumni, I loved my time at Oriel and it shaped my outlook on life. I have been lucky over the past 17 years to have been involved in various ways. Oriel is a wonderful community, and I feel deeply honored to be an honorary fellow." Mr. Skinner attended a dinner alongside three other heads of house from Oxford colleges and other distinguished guests.
Lord William Hague has been officially inaugurated as the new Chancellor of Oxford University. The former leader of the Conservative Party was admitted as the institution's 160th Chancellor in a ceremony that took place at the Sheldonian Theatre on 19th of February. After winning the election for the role in November 2024, crowds turned out to welcome Lord Hague back to the university where he studied in the 1970s and 80s. In his speech, Lord Hague said, "I thank all of you, the Convocation, for electing me as your Chancellor and for your enthusiastic welcome in recent weeks. Every visit I have made so far and every conversation has intensified my excitement about the years to come. I happily dedicate myself today to working with you and for you." The Chancellor went on to say that research and innovation advancement at Oxford University is fundamental to British prosperity. "It is in the public interest and in the critical national interest of the United Kingdom that we remain at the very forefront of the science and the applications of this change," he said. "What happens here is more fundamental to British prosperity than it has ever been. That means we must always maintain the highest and most rigorous standards of excellence, welcoming the most brilliant minds, irrespective of background." The university's Vice-Chancellor, Professor Irene Tracy, said, "I am delighted and honoured to welcome Lord Hague back to Oxford as our new Chancellor. His deep connection to the university and his commitment to its values, mission and vision will serve this world-class institution well during his tenure. He is a man of considerable integrity, wisdom and dedication. I look forward to working closely with him in the years ahead as we uphold and strengthen Oxford's legacy of excellence." The 62-year-old studied PPE, that's Philosophy, Politics and Economics, at Magdalen College before graduating in 1982. Arriving from a comprehensive school in South Yorkshire, he's always said that Oxford changed his life. Lord Hague's political career started at the age of 27 when he was elected the MP for Richmond, Yorkshire. He served for 26 years in the House of Commons in many senior roles, including First Secretary of State and Foreign Secretary, 2010 to 2014. Dame Fionn Haigh, his wife, read English at Jesus College and is an honorary fellow of Harris Manchester College. Lord Haigh won a majority of support from members of the convocation in the final round of voting for the post in November 2024. The new Chancellor will serve for a term of 10 years in the role that dates back at least 800 years.
A ban on visitors entering an Oxford home was extended by police amid ongoing concerns of antisocial behaviour. Thames Valley Police's Northeast Oxford neighbourhood team obtained an extension on a closure notice in Headington last week, the force said. The notice was put in place following concerns raised by neighbours and the community in Headington about antisocial behaviour within and around the property. A spokesperson for Thames Valley Police said, "If you have any concerns surrounding antisocial behavior within your community, please let us know so we can look to disrupt this. A 48-hour closure notice can be issued by police or the local authority if they believe activity connected to a property has or will cause a nuisance to the public." Campaigners say developers are making a mockery of the planning system over a bid to delay the reopening of an East Oxford community center which has seen its site redeveloped with flats. Several years ago, plans were permitted to demolish the East Oxford Games Hall and build 14 new flats on part of the site which is being redeveloped by Oxford City Council. Plans have now been lodged to remove a condition from the scheme which, if permitted, would mean the new East Oxford Community Centre, EOCC, would not have to be completed before the new flats are sold and rented out. Campaigners are angry because they say none of the groups based at the centre were consulted. These include Fusion Arts, BK Low, the African Caribbean Cultural Heritage Initiative, and the East Oxford Community Association. A spokesman for the campaign group Defend Community Space said, "If this condition is removed, it will send a clear message to developers that they can promise the earth to local residents, safe in the knowledge that any commitments made can simply be ignored with impunity and then dumped altogether down the line. This makes a mockery of the whole principle of planning conditions. And for a condition imposed by residents' elected representatives at committee to then be removed by a single unelected officer makes a mockery of local democracy. The EOCC redevelopment was supposed to be completed years ago, yet no work even began on the building until over a year after it was closed down. Developers have clearly prioritized the commercial flats over the community center, and now that the flats are near completion, they are using the threat of them standing empty to blackmail the council to drop the requirement to reopen the community center first. This is unacceptable. We fully support the objector's proposal that the flats should be occupied rent-free until the community center reopens to ensure developers retain an incentive to get on with the community center restoration." A spokesman for Oxford City Council said, "The community center is on target for completion in autumn 2025, with the new affordable homes at Collins Street due for completion early summer 2025. The decoupling of the sites is to allow Ox Place, on behalf of the City Council, to sell these new homes available via shared ownership to ensure that much-needed affordable homes in the city are not left standing empty. This has no impact on the delivery program for the works to the community center, which continued to progress well."
A number of independent bookshops in Oxfordshire are finalists of an esteemed award. Mostly Books on Sturt Street in Abingdon, the Wallingford Bookshop on St Martin Street in Wallingford and Caper on Magdalen Road in Oxford are all up for the British Book Awards 2025 Independent Bookshop of the Year. The British Book Awards, also known as the Nibbies, has been leading awards for the book trade since 1990. From a record number of submissions, they are among 72 independent bookshops listed as finalists across 9 different regions and countries, including 10 in Scotland, North England, London, South West England and South East England, respectively, and 7 in the Midlands. Within these regions, Bristol alone boasts 3 finalists, while 2 Manchester bookshops succeed for the first time, and Northern Ireland celebrates the most finalists ever, with 3 shops recognised. Tom Tivnan, the bookseller managing editor, said, "The last year has been a drab time for the high street, with declining footfall and rising prices. But what has been underscored by our regional and country finalists is that independent bookshops are beacons of hope amid the gloom. I've been judging this award for a decade and a half, and I have never seen such depth of quality and energy in the submissions. British and Irish indies continue to thrive despite the overall climate with entrepreneurship and creativity. These finalists are wonderfully unique and idiosyncratic, but there is a link in that all of them are not confined by the four walls of their shops. They're out in their communities, organising festivals, visiting schools, bringing authors to town. Sure, they sell a lot of books, but that is just the start. Independent bookshops are Britain and Ireland's local cultural linchpins." Merrill Halls, Managing Director of the Booksellers Association of the United Kingdom and Ireland, said, "From being trusted curators, to championing authors, to fostering communities of like-minded individuals, to bringing local jobs and essential footfall to shopping districts, the role that independent bookshops play within the book trade, wider society and economy is more vital than ever. We are delighted to see this superb selection of finalists and their invaluable contribution recognised as cornerstones of the book industry." Ruth Gardner, Gardner's UK sales manager, said, "Every independent bookshop has a unique story to tell, and we're proud to support those who make reading more accessible and magical for everyone. This award recognises their invaluable contribution. Independent bookshops are at the heart of the book world, bringing communities together and championing the joy of reading. We're proud to support the Independent Bookshop of the Year Award and would like to wish all entrants the very best of luck."
A campaign to establish a banking hub in Tame is gaining traction, with hundreds of people showing their support in an online survey. The survey, launched late last week, has already garnered more than 700 responses, with the overwhelming majority supporting the hub. The campaign for a banking hub in Tame follows a recent assessment by Link, which independently assesses communities' cash needs. The evaluation determined that Tame should be provided with an automated deposit service, ADS, machine at the Morrison's post office premises on Corn Market once the last bank, Lloyd's, has closed the week commencing 17th of February. Lloyd's will have a presence at the town hall, but it will not take deposits, while the ADS machine will provide limited cash deposit facilities only. While the Nationwide Building Society will remain in Tame after Lloyd's has closed, it does not offer business or charity banking services, and many fear community groups, charities, and businesses that take cash will have to travel to Aylesbury, Oxford, or High Wycombe for their banking services. Personal banking customers will have to do the same unless they switch to Nationwide. A banking hub would offer a broader range of services, including daily counter services for personal and business banking, with the major banks providing a face-to-face presence for queries on scheduled days each week. In making its decision for an ADS machine, Link assessed Tame as an urban location with a one-mile radius, failing to consider the town's rural hinterland, including large villages such as Haddenham and Chinnor, and smaller villages such as Towersey and Cheersley. With a population of over 30,000 within a five-mile radius, the surrounding villages depend on Tame for many of their needs, including banking services. Tame Town Council fully supports the need for a banking hub in Tame. It believes the ADS option is unsatisfactory, with a limited deposit service only, whereas more extensive banking services for personal and business banking are available in a banking hub, which the council believes is far more suitable for Tame and its large hinterland. School children got a rare chance to clown around when actors from Chipping Norton Theatre delivered a drama workshop at Cokethorpe School in Whitney. The first form year group took part in practical seminars on how to expand characterization skills, develop vocal techniques, as well as an exciting workshop in silent clowning. The school's promising young acting talents worked on expression, creativeness, and improvisation through fun games as they started to prepare for their end-of-year performance for family and friends. A Cokethorpe School spokesperson said, We are grateful to the members of Chipping Norton Theatre for the innovative and engaging tuition and look forward to the next time when we will welcome them to participate in the Cokethorpe Drama Course as part of our growing relationship.
Crime novelist Cara Hunter has revealed that Richard Armitage is her first choice to appear in a TV adaptation of her novels. The author's 7 Oxford-based novels, featuring Detective Inspector Adam Fawley, could be adapted for TV after a deal was struck for the rights to the series in 2020. Ms. Hunter, who lives in Oxford, was at Oxford Westgate Library recently, where she gave a talk to 40 fans, to coincide with the publication of her latest crime thriller, Making a Killing. During the talk, she confirmed that Richard Armitage remains her favourite to play the role of D.I. Adam Fawley on the small screen. The 9th series of Endeavour concluded in 2023, ending the Inspector Morse TV franchise and leaving a gap in the market for a new Oxford-based detective drama. Ms. Hunter told her audience that getting novels adapted for TV was a long process. She explained how she has been working with British television producer and screenwriter Daisy Coulomb, best known for writing ITV hit Grantchester. Mr. Armitage has starred in the Hobbit movies and 4 adaptations of Harlan Coben's mystery thrillers for Netflix. Ms. Hunter's series, set in the city, have been incredibly successful following the publication of her debut Close to Home in 2017, and the novels have sold more than 1 million copies worldwide. Manchester-based drama company Castlefield, part of media company Fremantle, picked up the rights to Ms. Hunter's novels. Ms. Hunter said in 2020, "I've always seen the Fawley books play out in my head as I write them, and the style I developed them for them was a deliberate attempt to replicate the feel and pace of the best TV crime, the short scenes, the fast pace, and the changing points of view." Following the talk and a question and answer session, the author signed copies of her latest novel, Making a Killing. She said that she and other Oxford-based crime writers were indebted to the huge legacy left by Inspector Morse author Colin Dexter. In Ms. Hunter's latest novel, when Nick Vincent, producer of true crime show Infamous, hears about an explosive new angle on a high-profile case, the 2016 murder of an 8-year-old girl in Oxford, he leaps at the chance to send a researcher to verify the claims. 2 months later, a dog walker discovers a woman's body bound and buried in the shallow grave in the woods. Forensic evidence links the corpse to the disappearance of the child. D.I. Fawley, the original investigating officer, is called in to run the inquiry. And he remembers the case well. He arrested the child's mother for murder, a murder he now knows she didn't commit. Making a Killing is published by HarperCollins, price £16.99.
Carlos Sainz, the driver mooted aside for Lewis Hamilton at Ferrari, believes his old team are on the cusp of winning the world championship and has backed his replacement to compete for a record 8th title. Hamilton, 40, is a month out from making his long-awaited debut for Ferrari following his tantalizing switch from Mercedes. Sainz was the fall guy for Hamilton's transfer, widely perceived to be among the biggest in Formula One history, and will instead line up for Williams when the season gets underway in Melbourne on March 16th. But speaking at the British team's launch at Silverstone, Sainz, 30, who spent 3 years alongside Charles Leclerc at Ferrari, said, "When I left, I did feel that both Ferrari and Charles were ready to fight for a world championship, and with Lewis joining, that is only going to increase. I have never been teammates with Lewis, so I don't know what he is capable of doing. I have never seen his data. I have seen Charles's data, and I know how good he is. The only way you can evaluate a driver is when you are a teammate and you see what they are capable of doing. But when I look at Lewis's results and his background and what he has achieved, I can only say that there will be a very high chance that he is going to be competitive for Ferrari. But like everything, it will all depend on how well he can adapt to the car and how well he can adapt to the team." Hamilton will take the wraps off his new Ferrari at F1 season launch at the O2 Arena in London before heading to Maranello a day later, where he is due to address the media for the first time as a Ferrari driver. Sainz will team up with Alex Albon at Williams for the new 24-round season. The London-born Albon has had the beating of his teammates since he arrived at Williams in 2022, but he faces a stern test this year. A 43-year-old man has said his 2-year-old daughter did not recognize him after he received a hair transplant at an Oxford clinic. Tony Negrelli said his youngest daughter kept her distance for 2 days after his procedure at Wimpole Clinic. A year on, he is celebrating the first anniversary of his hair transplant, saying it has boosted his confidence. He said, "I feel more confident now in my 40s than ever before, and barbers can actually do something with my hair now, so I get my money's worth." Mr. Negrelli said he had tried everything from vitamins to conditioners to stop his hair from receding, but nothing worked. He said, "My hair problems hit me in my 40s. I didn't want to be the oldest guy in the room picking up the kids at the playground." After seeing a colleague's transformation following a hair transplant in Turkey, Mr. Negrelli decided to pursue his own dream of a fuller head of hair. He was one of the first people to have a consultation at Wimpole Clinic's newly established Oxford Clinic. He had the procedure last year and was surprised to find that by 6 p.m. he was back home with his family. When asked what advice he would give to others considering the procedure, he said, "Why not? If it will make you happier and more confident, it's great value for money."
The restoration of a historic Oxford cemetery by volunteers has been recognised in an award from a heritage charity. Holywell Cemetery in St Cross Road was painstakingly restored by a group of volunteers over years. In the latest awards from the Oxford Preservation Trust, which recognises the best in conservation and new design in the city in a scheme established in 1977, the cemetery work was awarded a plaque in the landscape and public realm category. The project began in 2017 with the arrival of Reverend Canon Will Lamb as vicar of the University Church of St Mary the Virgin, when Holywell Cemetery was overgrown and neglected. Reverend Canon Lamb said, "The graves were completely overgrown, hidden under thick ivy and brambles. It was like a jungle." It wasn't always left in disrepair, as when a lodge was built beside the cemetery gate for the keeper to live in 1850, he created an admired garden as well as tended the graves. But this became neglected after the last cemetery caretaker retired in 1931, as parish funds ran out and fewer burials took place in the remaining plots. Friends of Holywell Cemetery formed shortly after the Reverend took up post, with the intention of restoring the cemetery and its historical features while protecting the biodiverse wildlife which made it its home since its neglect. In 2023, a Church of England Count on Nature survey identified more than 100 species of flora and fauna on the site. Wildlife management was continued in the cemetery with the addition of birdhouses and owl boxes to attract more birds, and it has regular visits from butterflies, pheasants, foxes and muntjac deer. The history of the site is likewise notable. Built in 1847 in response to the increasing need for burial sites in the city amid a cholera outbreak and concern for public health. Interesting graves include Kenneth Graham, author of The Wind in the Willows, who died in 1932. A celebrated brain surgeon in his day also has a resting place in the cemetery, Sir Hugh Cairns, who was Nuffield Professor of Surgery and who died in 1952. The founder of Blackwell's Bookshops, Benjamin Henry Blackwell, also has a plot on the site, buried there in 1924. A member of Friends of Holywell Cemetery, Bill Bannister Parker, said, "It's a delicate balance. We want to preserve these historically significant grave markers while protecting the wildlife that has made its home here." The volunteers have worked to clear pathways and restore visibility to the cemetery's significant graves and protect those in disrepair.
Railway signalers have been given the green light and are ready to welcome trains on the new east-west rail route between Oxford and Milton Keynes. The signalling technology used on the new railway line is the first of its kind in Britain, says Network Rail. Work to open the new route between Milton Keynes and Oxford has been completed in time for the railway's 200th anniversary year. Railway 200 marks the bicentenary of the invention of the first passenger railway between Darlington and Stockton in September 1825. Network Rail, along with a number of partners, completed building the £1.2 billion investment in Connection Stage 1 of the project in October. Since then, Network Rail has been collaborating with its industry partners to run test trains and prepare the infrastructure for future passenger and freight services. Gary Walsh, Route Director for West Coast South, said, "We are pleased to welcome further test trains on the brand new East-West Rail route between Milton Keynes and Oxford, where future passenger and freight services will benefit from some of the most advanced signaling technology in use on the British rail network." A Department for Transport spokesperson said, "We're committed to transforming rail connectivity across the country. We are proud to have completed the build of this highly anticipated route, improving transport connections between Oxford and Milton Keynes. We are now following usual procedure and working with partners and train providers to start passenger services as quickly as possible." Mark James, Alliance Director for East-West Rail Alliance, said, "We are extremely proud to have been a part of returning this railway line from Bicester to Bletchley back to the mainland passenger network for the first time in 50 years. We look forward to seeing passengers using the new infrastructure connecting the communities along the route and facilitating East-West Rail journeys." A brand new workstation has been created at Network Rail's Rugby Rail Operating Center, where the West Coast Main Line, Europe's busiest mixed-use railway, is controlled from. Officials say the Claydon workstation is equipped with the latest systems and software with an advanced signaling method, benefiting from high-capacity fiber connectivity to ensure trains run safely and reliably. The new rail route has created 6 jobs for newly qualified signalers in Rugby, Warwickshire, with a plan to expand the team when future phases of East-West Rail are built. 2 Oxfordshire firefighters are set to tackle a challenging military speed march in the Scottish Highlands. Graham Redding and Dave Bragg, who are both based at Rewley Fire Station, will participate in the annual Commando Speed March on Saturday, March 8th, raising funds for the Firefighters Charity and the Commando Association Charity. The nearly 7-mile march, with a steep first mile, includes military competitors wearing combat gear and carrying an additional weight of at least 36 pounds. In a unique twist, Mr. Redding and Mr. Bragg will don firefighting kit, including breathing apparatus instead of military gear. Although military teams aim to complete the task within an hour, the firefighters are uncertain about their own time frame, but are determined to finish. The challenge follows the historic route used for selecting personnel for commando training during the Second World War around Achnacarry Castle in the Scottish Highlands, which served as the HQ for the British Commando Training Centre from 1942 to 1945. Those who were unable to keep up with the pace would be failed and were returned to their units.
An award-winning play about Gareth Southgate's time as England manager will come to Oxford next year. Dear England, which was named Best New Play at the Olivier Awards last year, will embark on a nationwide tour later this year. The play, written by stage and screenwriter James Graham, had a sell-out run at the National Theatre before transferring to the West End in 2023. It is a fictionalised account of the struggles and successes of England's football teams. Mr. Southgate ended an 8-year stint as the national team boss in the wake of England's Euro 2024 final defeat to Spain, and the play has been updated to reflect his final chapter as manager. It will now visit 16 venues, starting in Plymouth on September the 15th, with stops in major cities including Newcastle, Liverpool and Birmingham, as well as Oxford. Mr. Graham said he had frequent sleepless nights about whether a production about football would translate to stage, but feels it has connected with people as the story is so moving and Mr. Southgate is such a compelling character. He said, "I didn't grow up in a world where theatre was in my life as a kid. Once I found it in school, I just couldn't believe the magic and the wonder of it. And so I've always gone through my career with that populist mindset, just going, what will connect with people who are non-traditional theatre-goers and traditional theatre-goers at the same time? and obviously doing a play about the national football team, felt like it had the potential to reach theatre audiences and non-theatre audiences as well, just because of the subject matter. So that was in its DNA, but we didn't know if it was going to work. Mr. Graham has written TV shows, including Sherwood, Brexit, The Uncivil War, and Channel 4's Brian and Maggie. He said he's really delighted the play will tour across the country, as he feels it is a national play. He said the England football team belongs to everybody nationwide, and to take it out of the capital felt really, really important to me. Through November, Dear England will be at the Leeds Grand Theatre, Theatre Royal Newcastle and Chichester Festival Theatre. And in January 2026, the show will tour to Mayflower Theatre in Southampton, Milton Keynes' Theatre and the New Theatre, Oxford. Ahead of the tour, the play will return to the National Theatre from March to May, followed by a four-week run at the Lowry in Salford from May to June.
More than £300,000 will be spent on graffiti removal over a four-year period in Oxford. Oxford City Council agreed to fund the scheme, as well as more spending to increase grass verge cutting at least three times a year and increased litter picking as part of its 2025-26 budget. The annual meeting on Thursday heard there had been a demand from the public to remove graffiti in a timely fashion. Over the course of the four-year program, which would cost the council £310,000, graffiti would be removed where it is reported to the City Council, while currently only offensive graffiti is removed at speed. Ed Turner, City Council Cabinet Member for Finance, said, "One thing we have heard loud and clear from people is that we need to get the basics right before we do anything else. They have a reasonable expectation for graffiti that is unsightly, but not offensive, should be removed in a timely fashion. We try really hard to support the services and the organizations that support the most vulnerable." Other features of the budget include building two new community centers in East Oxford and Blackbird Lea, a new splash park for Hinksey, £100,000 to replace outdoor gym equipment, and £157,000 for additional gridding of pavements and bike lanes. The council will also put £2.5 million towards the Cowley branch line and a further £1 million towards the £8 million redevelopment of the covered market. Housing was also high on the list of priorities, with the council outlining funding to build 1,275 new council homes over the next 8 years and buy a further 283 more. This would bring total number of council homes to more than 9,500. A further £49 million would be spent on safety and compliance works, £84 million in the fabric of properties, including new kitchens and bathrooms, and £30 million towards energy efficiency targets, which make homes warmer and more energy efficient. A group of campaigners from the Socialist Party protested outside the town hall during the meeting, saying the projected amount of council house building is not enough to meet housing demand and to implement rent controls. They also argued the council should do more to support the elderly during the winter. Council tax on Band D properties will increase by 2.99%, or £10.36 per year, which amounts to a total of £356.72. Residents who are on the lowest incomes will continue to receive a full discount on council tax. The Labour group put forward an amendment to their own budget, which absorbed several Liberal Democrat budget proposals. This included extra funding to improve walkability of the city and £60,000 over 2 years for a city centre playground, subject to a location being found. The budget passed with 30 votes for, 1 against, and 16 abstentions. Two Oxfordshire schools have received donations to allow them to take part in a national RSPB campaign. To celebrate the Big Schools Birdwatch, Barrett and David Wilson Holmes donated wildlife observational packs to Thomas Reed Primary School in Abingdon and Stanford in the Vale Primary School near Farringdon. The packs, which include a magnifying glass, binoculars, and a compass, helped pupils to observe birds in the school grounds. The Big Schools Birdwatch is a nationwide project where pupils count the number of birds they see at school and submit their results. This research helps to create a picture of how birds are faring across the UK. Lindsay Day, head teacher at Thomas Reed Primary School, said, "Thank you very much to Barrett and David Wilson Holmes for these wonderful packs. We are very excited to see the children use the wildlife observational resources and hear about what they have learned." Barrett and David Wilson Holmes have partnered with the RSPB since 2014 to show how new homes and homeowners can help nature and support wildlife. Emma Hawkins, sales director at Barrett and David Wilson Holmes Southern, said, "As a leading house builder, we strive to give nature a home, and it's important we make sure school pupils are invested in their local wildlife too."
An Oxford University college librarian has spoken of her surprise following a large donation of Alice in Wonderland memorabilia. Thousands of letters, photographs, illustrations and books from one of the world's largest private Lewis Carroll collections have been donated to the UK out of the blue by an American philanthropist. The gift has been made to Christ Church College, where Carroll lectured and where he met Alice Liddell, the inspiration for Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which celebrates its 160th anniversary this year. Since 2005, the city has celebrated its connection with the Alice stories with a series of events on Alice's Day, staged in the summer. The collection includes more than 200 autographed letters, some of which are unpublished. There are a number to his child friends and their parents, often sending riddles and jokes, as well as copies of books. Some shed light on the author's interest in the theatre. There are also significant early editions, including the Alice books, The Hunting of the Snark, and mathematical works. A copy of Alice's Adventures Underground is inscribed to Alice's mother, which says, "To her, whose children's smiles fed the narrator's fancy and were his rich reward, from the author, Christmas 1886. Gabriel Sewell, the Christchurch College librarian, was surprised when she received a brief email from the US collector, who wrote, "I have decided to donate my Lewis Carroll collection. It includes more than 200 letters and 100 photographs, plus many obscure printed items. Have you any interest?" The email was sent by John A. Linseth, a retired American businessman and philanthropist, collector and scholar. Masul told The Guardian, "It was a bit of a surprise. It's an enormous collection. He's incredibly generous. It would be impossible to make a collection like this nowadays without having an enormous amount of money. Such material doesn't come onto the market these days, and not all at once. When we've tried to buy Carroll photographs, we've never had enough money. They get snapped up by people with much deeper pockets." Christchurch owns one of the biggest Carroll archives. Masul added, "With this unparalleled donation from Linseth, there can be no doubt that the college is now the preeminent institutional collection of Carroll material in the UK. An exhibition of some of the items donated will remain on display in the college's upper library until April the 17th.
A new development of 150 apartments has opened in Botley. The Kimmeridge is said to be Oxford's first ever build-to-rent scheme, and 20% of the homes were leased in the opening weekend, says the developers. Offering homes ranging from 1 to 3 bedroom apartments, the building spans 8 stories and features more than 2,000 square feet of shared spaces for residents. Prices for a one-bedroom apartment start from £1,675 per month, with two-bedroom apartments starting at £2,155 per month. These include a courtyard on the first floor and a rooftop terrace on the 7th floor. The building also has a gym, a resident lounge with a dining room and kitchenette, co-working spaces with private meeting pods, as well as a private hire meeting room. A cycle store and 7 commercial retail units on the ground floor are also available to residents. Helen Gordon, chief executive of Granger PLC, said, "We're delighted to celebrate the official opening of the Kimmeridge, bringing build-to-rent as a brand new way of renting to Oxford." The Kimmeridge also features circa 10,100 square feet of commercial space on the ground floor of the development, which is available for business rentals. The county's policing chief has condemned disruption caused by pony and trap racing on the A40 last weekend. Matthew Barber, the Police and Crime Commissioner for the Thames Valley region, has called for legislation change after the racing along the carriageway near Whitney. Mr. Barber was responding to the disruption in West Oxfordshire, which he said has been going on for many years. Racing also took place near Jeremy Clarkson's pub, The Farmer's Dog, in Astall near Burford. Mr. Barber said that while the organized events are not illegal, anyone can race horses on public highways under the law. It still causes disruption to traffic, antisocial behavior, and intimidation to local residents. A large event originally organized to take place in Chalfont St. Peter, Buckinghamshire, in the early hours of last Saturday, was prevented by a Section 34 dispersal order from police. Instead, organizers relocated the racing to the A40 in Whitney, where despite people in the area raising concerns, the disruption was minimal. However, a large police presence in the area monitored the event and ensured no illegal activity took place. One vehicle was seized from the racers for having no insurance, and two drivers were reported for other traffic offenses at the gathering. The Section 34 order allows police to direct people to leave an area for a set period of time and is typically used to deal with antisocial behavior. Police guidance states the officer must be satisfied the use of this power is necessary to remove or reduce the likelihood of harassment, alarm, or distress to the public. The authorization can typically last up to 48 hours for these orders. Mr. Barber said dispersing the Buckinghamshire event and monitoring the Whitney race was costly. He added, Thames Valley Police cannot mount such intense operations on a regular basis without seriously damaging the day-to-day policing on which we all rely. He said he has written to the Department of Transport and both MPs for the areas affected, asking them to consider a change in the legislation to prohibit pony and trap racing on public roads. This would require organizers to get permission ahead of races and meet certain conditions, making events better managed and less disruptive, as well as giving police direct powers to tackle unauthorized racing. A spokesperson for Thames Valley Police said that due to the large gathering of pony and traps, there was a significant police presence in the area.
The world's first centre dedicated to empowering global epilepsy research and care has been launched at the University of Oxford. The Centre for Global Epilepsy, based at Wolfson College within the university, aims to tackle the global burden of epilepsy, especially in resource-limited settings. Researchers from academic institutions in Africa, South America, the United States and Europe congregated to celebrate the launch and demonstrate their commitment to global epilepsy research and care. The centre aims to link expertise from high-income settings with those in resource-limited environments to drive advancements in epilepsy research, diagnosis, treatment and care. Professor Arjun Sen, Director of the Oxford Martin Programme on Global Epilepsy, Chief Executive of the Centre for Global Epilepsy and Professor of Neurology at the University of Oxford, said, "It is a great privilege and pleasure to lead the Centre for Global Epilepsy. Even though more than 50 million people have the condition, for far too long epilepsy has been marginalised. Propelled by the power and goodwill of close collaborators and friends, we are determined to make positive impacts that deliver real-world benefits for those who happen to have seizures. Globally, more than 50 million people live with epilepsy, yet around 85% lack access to accurate diagnosis or effective treatment. Barriers include costs, limited availability of anti-seizure medications, and a shortage of trained healthcare professionals. The centre's launch event, opened by Wolfson College President Sir Tim Hitchens, highlighted epilepsy as a focus for global health.
Gary Rowett was disappointed by the overall performance as his Oxford United side were beaten for the first time on home soil under him. The U's lost 2-0 against Portsmouth, with goals coming from Andre Dozzle and Mark O'Mahony at either end of the second half. For large periods, United were clumsy in possession with poor decision-making halting any progress up the pitch. U's head coach Rowett said, "I thought our performance was just a little bit too rigid in the first half. We needed to play with a little bit more freedom in certain areas, and I thought we got into some really good positions. It's been creeping in the last three or four games. that final pass and final action to get someone into a goal-scoring position just hasn't quite been there. There's been the disappointment because we've got into some great positions. There was one where Ruben Rodriguez just needed to dink it over the defender for Shemi Plachetta, and he plays it too hard and the goalkeeper is there. They did what they did, which was kick the left back up and go really long with the goalkeeper to try and create a game of seconds and a little bit of a fight. I thought when we showed composure, we got into good areas, and in the second half, you could see it. We conceded a very poor goal from a set piece with bodies in the box, and we don't deal with it, and you end up 1-0 down. We had three absolutely clear-cut chances where we should score all three of them, let alone one of them, and we don't. We chased the game at the end, and we obviously left ourselves open, but again, it was a poor goal. It was a disappointing performance overall, but I think we still did more than enough to get something out of the game, but you've got to go and finish things off. He added, I think we've done enough in the games to warrant people keeping their place, but people have to perform. I said that at halftime. I could have taken all the front four off in some ways because we didn't create enough. It's not just the four. You can't start dissecting the game and saying it's about the defenders keeping clean sheets and the forwards scoring. You have to work hard as a team and be accountable as a team, but certainly when you get into those areas, someone has to produce something. There was one where Stan Mills flashed a ball across the box and the space was there and everyone was pulling back for a nice goal. You don't score nice goals all the time in the championship. You have to throw yourself in there. There were some areas of the pitch where we certainly need to work hard and be a little bit braver and throw a few more bodies in the box to score the goal. A cross-Atlantic charity rowing mission has been supported by an Oxford University researcher. Dr. Sepeda Chakava, a lecturer in data science, AI, and software engineering, played a key role in the Row for Ukraine mission. The mission aimed to raise awareness about the human cost of the war in Ukraine and to raise funds for the rehabilitation of Ukrainian service personnel. The team, made up of injured servicemen from the UK and Ukraine, aimed to row 3,000 miles from Gran Canaria to Barbados in less than 6 weeks. However, the British and Ukrainian crew members did not share a common language, making communication a significant challenge. Dr. Chakava and her team developed a first-of-its-kind applied AI communication tool with embedded translation that functions entirely offline. This tool, Pixels Chat, supports hundreds of languages but typically requires an internet connection. However, Dr. Chakava and her team created a bespoke version that functions entirely offline, making it the first ever real-time embedded translated communication tool capable of operating without internet access. Row for Ukraine team leader, former Royal Marine and world record holder for rowing from Europe to South America, Lee Spencer, said, "There will be times when we need to communicate complex information quickly and safely to avoid danger, and times when your emotions will build up. Not being able to communicate how you feel, any perceived grievances, will lead to a deterioration in team spirit. Team spirit is what's going to get us across, so being able to communicate is incredibly important."
Blenheim Palace will hold its first duathlon this summer, alongside its annual triathlon. The event will take place on Sunday, June the 8th, giving participants a choice of two distances. The half duathlon will comprise a 5K run, 22K cycle, and another 5K run, while the full duathlon will be made up of a 10K run, 44K cycle, and 5K run. The event will take place alongside Blenheim's annual triathlon, scheduled for Saturday, 7th of June, and Sunday, 8th of June. The Blenheim Palace Triathlon Weekend will now feature a total of six distances across the 2 days, with the triathlon options of Super Sprint, Sprint, Sprint Relay and Weekend Warrior. Andy Taylor, race director, said, "While we always see such a variety of experience levels at Blenheim each year, with a large number of beginners, we know that open water swimming can be a barrier. This is why we wanted to provide the option for 2025 to run, bike, run, and open up this spectacular event to even more people. The whole weekend is designed for people of all levels, from beginners to seasoned pros, and it is seen as a great way for runners and cyclists to begin building their way up to taking part in a triathlon. We're very excited about hosting the Duathlon at Blenheim Palace Triathlon this year and hope to grow the event further each year.
And Oxford University College is to celebrate the achievements of women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Exeter College will hold a program this spring to include panel discussions, talks, poster sessions, an Ask a Scientist corner, and a networking reception. There will also be an outreach initiative to engage local schools in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, so-called STEM subjects. The event aims to foster community building, alumni engagement, equality, diversity, and inclusion, as well as access and outreach. The colleges Ray Tressa and Amber Beber have invited those interested in participating, whether by joining a panel or presenting their research, to get in touch. The college has given a preview of the event by speaking to Anda Raluca Epur, a first-year DPhil student in healthcare data science. She has been interested in maths from a young age and did her Master's of Science in Advanced Computer Science at Oxford's Hertford College after completing a Bachelor's in Science in Mathematics with Economics at University College London. Ms. Epur said, "For me, being a woman in STEM is one of the most amazing, challenging, but rewarding journeys in life. When joining this field, where women have been historically underrepresented, you need to be prepared to stay ambitious, perseverant, and passionate about your subject. I believe being a woman in STEM can be compared to being a superhero undercover, always staying brave, innovative, supportive, and ready to change the world." Ms. Epur also highlighted the importance of role models in her journey, mentioning her lecturer in computational medicine, Professor Blanca Rodriguez, and Professor Dame Molly Stevens from Exeter College. She said, "My lecturer in computational medicine, Professor Blanca Rodriguez, was the one inspiring me to pursue my current degree, showing me by example how impactful and exciting applications of machine learning and modeling techniques can be in the context of cardiovascular research. In addition, for me, Professor Dame Molly Stevens from Exeter College is an example of how women in STEM can conduct meaningful research while also leading a diverse, multidisciplinary group."
A homelessness charity has received a £3,000 donation to help it to continue providing accommodation. Homeless Oxfordshire, which was founded in 1985 as the Oxford Night Shelter, is the largest non-profit accommodation provider for people experiencing homelessness in the county. Lisa Clothier, the charity's head of fundraising and communications, said, "For people experiencing homelessness, we provide an open door, offering safety, stability, and support when it's needed most. Donations like these form a vital part of our funding and enable us to continue providing much needed accommodation and support to those affected by homelessness. Thanks to generous donations like this one, we're also able to offer life-enhancing initiatives, such as our activity and engagement programme, where residents can revisit old skills and explore new interests like art, music, and cooking. The charity specialises in supporting people whose complex needs are often the result of lifelong disadvantage and challenges, such as poverty, trauma, and deep social exclusion. Campbell Gregg, Managing Director at Barrett and David Wilson Homes, Southern, which made the donation, said, "We're honoured to support Homeless Oxfordshire in its ongoing mission to tackle homelessness in the local community."
An Oxfordshire MP has welcomed an investment of almost £1 million for the refurbishment of Wantage Community Hospital's ground floor. The funds will allow the hospital to accommodate more clinic-based services across physical health care and mental health. Wantage at Didcot MP Ollie Glover praised the work of the people involved. He said, "I very much welcome the investment to improve outpatient facilities at Wantage Community Hospital. This reflects the hard work of many local councillors, including County Councillors Jane Hanna and Jenny Hannaby. Health infrastructure has lagged behind the rate of housing growth in and around Wantage for many years, so it is great to see partnerships working to bring forward this refurbishment using community infrastructure funding. The majority of the funding, which came from Vale of the White Horse District Council Community Infrastructure Levy Fund, follows extensive liaison over the last 9 months. This saw the initial estimate of £600,000 increased to nearer to £900,000 to reflect the needs identified by the local community to move care closer to home and co-locate more mental health and physical health care services at the hospital. Councillor Jane Hanna, County Councillor for Wantage and Grove, said, "I am delighted at the progress that has been made to date and the funding that has been allocated for investment in our local community hospital. A public meeting is scheduled for late February, which is when more detail will be provided on the design and anticipated timelines for work to start on refurbishing the hospital's ground floor, along with the likely services that will be coming to use the space." In a Facebook post, Ms. Hanna added, "Great investment in Wantage Community Hospital and all residents in the local area. Excited to share that the hospital is getting near £1 million capital, up from £600,000 promised, saving clinics that save residents a day trip to Oxford hospitals and new clinics planned from September 2025. Jenny Hannaby and I have been meeting with the NHS every 2 weeks. Great support from Wantage Town Council Health Committee and the Oxfordshire County Council Health Scrutiny, including local councillor Dr. Paul Barrow, and from Ollie Glover, Liberal Democrat MP for Didcot and Wantage. This shows how strong relationships across local organizations all working to a shared purpose can deliver even in challenging times. Local NHS bosses are on record this will continue for our area. Do come to the public meeting on February 27th in the Silver Band Hall to hear more about the hospital build and new clinical services for young and old."
A building supplies business run for 75 years in Oxfordshire has closed all four of its branches for good. Blanchford & Co Limited, also known as Blanchford Building Supplies, which had its headquarters in Headington, shut all four of its shops on Friday the 14th of February. The family-run business was opened by a trio of brothers Fred, Cecil and Ronald Blanchford in 1938 and retained its independence throughout its time. The first sister branch was opened in Prince's Risborough, Buckinghamshire, in the 1960s, and the company continued expanding to shops in Wallingford and Bicester to better serve Oxfordshire, in addition to its Oxford headquarters. The loss of the four branches will affect the approximately 80 employees which worked for Blanchford, and many more expressed their sorrow that the company would be gone. It provided tailored services to private and corporate customers, which included everything from plumbing and heating, kitchens and bathrooms, to timber, ironmongery, paint, tools and plants. People described the closure as a huge loss for the areas it served, with one customer saying, "Our town is losing a real asset."
A new drive-through electric vehicle charging station could be coming to a site near an unusable multi-million-pound park-and-ride site near the city. Plans have been lodged by FastNed UK for 8 charging spaces, a toilet block, associated substation with signs on the junction of the A40 and B4449 near Ensham. The scheme also includes a small building which would house toilets and vending machines for hot and cold drinks. The site is close to a multi-million pound 19-acre park-and-ride site, which has no access road and is lying empty, unable to be used. The charging station plans have so far received no public comments in support or objection. In the application's planning papers, it said the scheme is needed to help achieve the government's target of zero net carbon emissions by 2050. The applicant added that the development is needed to help boost the UK's electric vehicle charging infrastructure. The phrase of range anxiety has long been used, caused by the possibility of not completing a journey due to the lack of charge, but this is now coupled with charger anxiety, due to not knowing when or where a charger will be found. The planning statement said, "The EV charging station will provide 8 EV charging spaces comprising rapid charging facilities for up to 8 vehicles being deployed simultaneously. The strategic location of the proposed site at the junction of Hanborough Road and the B4449 provides a convenient link to Ensham Village Centre, as well as the A40. This prime location ensures excellent accessibility for residents, commuters, and visitors." It added, The site itself is a gently sloping, grassy plot surrounded by a mixture of mature trees and overgrown shrubs, providing a sense of enclosure and natural screening. To the west, the site is bordered by a dense vegetated field, while to the east, the B4449 connects the area with the A40. A residential area, separated from the site by Hanborough Road, lies to the south. The proximity to major roads ensures that the site is well connected. The amenity unit would comprise a small unmanned building with a gross external floor area of 24.3 square meters and would contain the ancillary facilities required for the electric vehicle charging. The building has been designed to accommodate an accessible WC and a variety of vending machines, including hot and cold beverages. Retained trees will need to be considered as part of the site and protected at every stage of the scheme from the potentially negative. An Oxford University student has shared his story of surviving hurricanes, beating future professional tennis players, and family struggles. Maximilian Kiefer is studying with Oxford University in the computer science department. His grandfather was part of the Hitler Youth and later dug trenches in the Second World War. Another great-grandfather fought as a machine gunner during the Battle of Okinawa, later serving in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Mr. Kiefer said, "My early childhood was marred by nature's fury. At the age of 9, I survived Hurricanes Katrina, Ivan, and another unnamed storm in 2004 while living in Vero Beach, Florida. In the aftermath of the hurricane, we endured a month without hot food, electricity, or the comforts of modern life. Our family tennis club, which we owned for 5 years, was showered with hundreds of sea crabs that had been swept from the ocean. It was a surreal scene. Crabs littered the club's property and roads like a biblical storm. Instagram and smartphones didn't exist in 2004, so no one documented these extraordinary events. Despite this, Mr. Kiefer excelled at tennis as a child, beating future professional Riley Opelka. After the hurricanes, his family moved to Switzerland. He said, "The transition was difficult, especially since I experienced intense xenophobia from the Swiss towards Americans. This hostility made it nearly impossible to integrate into the tennis and golf communities, despite my skill level. I did, however, manage to play and beat Swiss tennis stars Belinda Bencic and Marc-Andrea Hüsler." Mr. Kiefer added, "During my time at Carnegie Mellon, I worked for both a startup and the university as a research assistant." Despite facing challenges, such as a plagiarism accusation, I managed to recover and completed dual majors and a minor. I even ventured into robotics and engineering, despite my social science focus. Alongside two engineers, I helped build a device to attract and eliminate Asian citrus psyllids, a pest threatening citrus plants, which is currently being tested by the USDA. Following this, I moved to Weehawken, New Jersey to work as a software engineer for UBS. But during my vacation, another family secret emerged. My sisters were only my half-sisters. Despite these personal shocks, I threw myself into work and continued to pursue higher education, eventually being accepted into prestigious programs at ETH, Dartmouth, Columbia, and Oxford. During this turmoil, I went back to Weehawken and spent 2.5 years completing my degrees and working remotely. Despite these personal challenges, I have managed to accomplish a great deal, including publishing 2 books.
Visitors flocked to Cogs Manor Farm as it opened for a new season. Families enjoying the start of the half-term holidays were able to see the farmyard animals, including sheep, goats, ponies, chickens, ducks, and turkeys, as well as rare breeds such as a new Hamburg chicken. Children enjoyed craft activities led by volunteers and sampled baking from the range in the manor house. Guy Reed, general manager, said, "We're really delighted to swing open the doors again and welcome visitors. Despite the grey skies, we had plenty of visitors brave the fresh air, banish the winter gloom of staying indoors, and get out and about at Cogs. Our volunteers have worked hard to get us ready for the new season. The house in particular is beautifully dressed with vases of spring flowers."
National Trust properties across Oxfordshire are gearing up for Easter trails this spring. Events will be held at properties around the county, as well as those in neighbouring Buckinghamshire and Berkshire. Grays Court near Henley, Claydon and Watterson near Bicester, and Chaselton near Chipping Norton offer families a variety of outdoor activities, games, and crafts. There are also activities at Cliveden, Hunedin, and Besildon Park. The trails will run during the school holidays and over the Easter Bank holiday weekend from April 18th to the 21st. Each trail, inspired by aspects of nature, beauty, and history, provides a unique experience for families. Participants will receive a pair of bunny ears, a map guiding them to 10 activity stations, and an activity card to take home. The trail offers an opportunity for families to engage in traditional sports and village vet games. Each trail ends with a chocolate egg or a vegan chocolate egg. The trails will cost £3.50 per child, in addition to the standard National Trust admission fee or free entry for National Trust members. At Watterson near Bicester, the Easter Trail will run from April 9th to the 21st from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Participants will start at the north front of the manor and stop at 10 activity stations before heading to the stables to collect their chocolate egg. In addition to the trail, Watterson offers a woodland playground, a giant contour slide, climbing frames, and an aviary featuring rare and exotic birds. Gray's Court near Henley in South Oxfordshire will host Easter Showtime from April 5th to the 27th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The event invites families to step into Lady Brunner's world with a performance-themed show featuring music, games, and other activities. Other children's entertainment at Gray's Court includes a play area nestled in the woodland and space for den building. Chaselton, near Morton and Marsh, will host the Wildlife on the Wilderness Walk event from April 18th to the 21st, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Families can explore the Wilderness Walk and discover more about its wildlife before heading to the house to spot 10 Easter bunnies. The Jacobean house has remained virtually unchanged for 400 years. Also on the Oxfordshire border at Basildon Park near Reading, visitors can enjoy Easter Adventures, a Mansion Makeover, from April 5th to the 27th between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. Visitors will be able to check out the miniature mansion and run from pillar to post, choose colors from the color wheel, and puzzle the mansion floor plan back in order, as well as enjoy games, activities, and a chocolate egg.
People will have the chance to fly a drone, experience virtual reality, and meet a robotic dog at next month's Oxford Brookes Science Bazaar. The free annual event, aimed at children aged 5 to 16, attracts hundreds of families from across Oxfordshire and beyond. This year it will feature 70 interactive activities, including the chance to tackle Lego challenges, create a comic book with artist Neil Cameron, and explore psychology, environmental science, and human biology through interactive activities such as brain teasers and making slime. Visitors will also be able to get up close with the Premier League trophy. Dr. Ellie Beeman, Public and Community Engagement Coordinator at Oxford Brookes University and organiser of the Science Bazaar, said, "We aim to inspire children's curiosity across a range of disciplines, including technology, engineering, art, maths and social sciences." The Science Bazaar will take place from 9:30 to 4:30 on Saturday, March the 1st. From 9:30 to 11:30, the event will offer a relaxed, autism-friendly session with reduced ticketing. From 11:30 onwards, it will be open to everyone.
Notice to listeners of OxTalk who use a smart speaker to access our service. There are new instructions for anyone who listens to OxTalk using Alexa. To listen to OxTalk in this way, you now have to use the Talking Newspaper skill. First, you need to enable it. Simply say, "Alexa, enable Talking Newspaper." Then, to listen to OxTalk, please follow this procedure.
Alexa, open Talking Newspaper.
Welcome to your Talking Newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have problems listening to Ox Talk in this way, it could be due to the way that your Alexa device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set up your device in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact Oxtalk and we will try to help. That was the last of our articles for this week. If you have any comments or feedback about Oxtalk, you can telephone Margaret on 07496 062280. That's 07496 062280. Please remember to leave your name and a contact number with your message. Alternatively, you can send an email to mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and those from previous weeks are available on our website, www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen directly or download the audio file. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more news, so until then, we hope you have a good week.